This hearing before the Senate Subcommittee on Immigration, Border Security, and Citizenship will come to order. I want to thank Chairman Spector for scheduling today's hearing, and of course I appreciate our ranking member, Senator Kennedy, for his enormous contributions to this hearing and on this subject. There's a great American tradition of providing safe haven for refugees, a tradition that dates back to the founding of our nation. The United States accepts more refugees than any other country in the world. The Refugee Resettlement Program advances our national interests and our democratic values. And let us not forget, it saves lives. However, while the refugee ceiling remains at 70,000, the government has not consistently been able to meet this threshold established by the President. One explanation often cited for the inability to meet this threshold is that legitimate refugees are barred because the definition of terrorist activity is too broad. Under provisions of the Immigration and Nationality Act, refugees may be denied entry into the United States on terrorism grounds because they provided, quote, material support, close quote, to terrorist organizations. Yet there are more than 10 million refugees around the world. I question whether the material support issue alone can account for the United States not achieving the capped goals. And so I look forward to hearing from our panelists about other obstacles to reaching the refugee admission ceiling too. Finally, I believe it's important to examine how refugee assistance funds are spent by the Department of State. Many critics have asserted that in the past, the State Department has spent most of its refugee assistance funding on short-term needs like food, medicine, and housing. Obviously, while these needs are critical, we must not lose sight of the long-term needs of the refugees, including education, skills development, and integration into the host country. With that, let me turn the floor over to Senator Kennedy for any opening statement he'd like to make.
Thank you very much, Senator Cornyn, for holding these hearings, and thank you for also your leadership in this committee and on this issue. We welcome the opportunity to join with you in meeting with the Secretary of State recently, and also with our panelists on that particular occasion. So we thank you very much for giving chance to have out in the open the refugee policy and the administration's position. The committee has the important responsibility to analyze the conditions around the world affecting refugee protection, resettlement, help U.S. refugee admissions program to respond more effectively to the challenges facing it. As the chairman pointed out, each year countless refugees are forced to leave their countries fleeing persecution. America has always been the haven for those desperate for such protections. At the very beginning of our history, the refugees, pilgrims seeking religious freedom, landed on Plymouth Rock. Ever since, we've welcomed refugees. It's made us a better nation. And refugees represent the best of American values. They have stood alone at great personal cost against hostile governments for fundamental principles like freedom of speech and religion. They fled bombings, gunfire, torture, rape, genocide, and they've endured unspeakable misery and suffering. But they also bring with them the personal stories of hope and courage and triumph, and America offers them an opportunity for a new life, to live without fear, to go as far as their talent and energy allow, and we, in turn, are enriched by their presence. The estimated decline in the refugee population worldwide from 16.4 million in 2000 to 13.1 million is welcome news, but it is disturbing that more than 7 million refugees have been restricted to camps or isolated settlements for a decade or more, the warehousing issue. They are trapped in various places around the world, Burmese refugees in Thailand, Bhutanese in Nepal, Angolans in Zambia, Congo Kinshasa, and Namibia, 280,000 Eritreans in the Sudan. Yet in this legislative year, which ends in a few days, the U.S. is expected to admit fewer than 42,000 refugees in this fiscal year, even though the admissions target was set at 70. As a result, nearly 28,000 refugee slots have been wasted this year alone. Over the past decade, the refugee admissions program has fallen behind its admission goals by an average of 19,000 per year. The trend shouldn't continue. It's contrary to Americans' heritage and history. It allows needless suffering of innocent refugees to persist, gives an excuse to other countries to not do their part. Deserving refugees were available to fill most of these 28,000 slots. More than half were slated to be filled by refugees who were otherwise eligible, were excluded by their association with groups that are no threat to the United States and have not been identified by the National Intelligence Director, Negroponte, or Secretary Rice, or Counterterrorism Coordinator Crumpton, as groups of concern. Many of the groups have common goals with the United States in opposing oppressive regimes such as those in Burma and Cuba. Nevertheless, the administration applies the broad definition of terrorism to keep them out, and we have to hear today how the State Department and DHS intends to address this problem so we can admit more deserving refugees. There have been some positive changes in the refugee program, such as extending refugee admission to North Koreans and greater attention to stateless and warehouse populations. We had a chance to review those at our meeting. And I commend the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, many refugee and humanitarian organizations, their extraordinary commitment to resolving these problems. I look forward to the testimony of distinguished witnesses, particularly in the areas of funding refugee assistance and protecting Iraqi refugees for solutions for long-term refugees, and the Darfur crisis. That's of special interest. And we understand, we had talked, I think, at the time of our meeting about some of the resources that were necessary to try and process some of the both immigration and refugees, and we understand that there might be some positive news about that, which hopefully we'll hear about. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Kennedy. At this time, we'll make part of the record the opening statement of Senator Leahy and Senator Feingold without objection. Our first witness is the Honorable Ellen Sabre, Assistant Secretary of the Department of State for Population, Refugees, and Migration. She was appointed to that position by President Bush on January the 12th, 2006. Before her appointment as Assistant Secretary, Ms. Sabre served as U.S. Representative to the United Nations Commission on the Status of Women. In that capacity, she led the U.S. delegation to the Baltic Sea Conference on Women and Democracy in Estonia and has spoken at numerous international women's conferences. We also have with us Mr. Jonathan Sharfin, Deputy Director of the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services at the Department of Homeland Security. He was appointed by Director Emilio Gonzalez on June 22, 2006. Before his appointment to that responsibility, to that job, Mr. Sharfin served in the United States Marine Corps and retired in August 2003 at the rank of colonel following 25 years of active duty service. Mr. Sharfin also previously served as Chief Counsel and Deputy Staff Director of the House International Relations Committee. I would like to ask you please to stand so I can administer the oath. Both of you swear the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God. Thank you very much. Please be seated. Let me start with Ms. Sharfin, with the Honorable Sabre. Would be glad to hear your opening statement, please.
Thank you, Senators. I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to participate in this afternoon's public hearing on the President's Refugee Admissions Program for 2007. And I want to tell you, I'm very passionate about this program, and I share the passion that I heard from you. The administration is committed to maintaining a robust admissions program as an integral component of our effort to promote the President's freedom agenda and to champion human dignity globally. Though fiscal year 2006 has been a challenging year, there is a lot of good news to report about this very important humanitarian program. Among the best news is the fact that worldwide population of refugees is indeed at its lowest level in 26 years. By the end of 2005, the estimated refugee population worldwide had declined to 13 million. 8.7 million of those are under the care of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, and most of the remainder is under the care of UNRWA. Millions of Liberians, Afghans, Sudanese, Burundis, and others have been able to return to their homelands or have found permanent refuge in asylum locations. The President has proposed that the United States this year admit up to 70,000 refugees. We would allocate 50,000 of the refugee numbers among regions based on existing or identified caseloads. The unallocated reserve of 20,000 would be used as we identify and are in the process of identifying additional refugee populations for processing. I recently had the opportunity to visit three refugee hosting countries in Southeast Asia, Bangladesh, Malaysia, and Thailand, and saw very clear evidence of the need to extend the reach of our program to thousands of Burmese refugees who require resettlement if they are going to be able to end the limbo of living in these protracted situations. We come into this year with a healthy number of refugees, nearly 20,000, in advanced stages of resettlement processing. And we are already working with our overseas partners to process several large new populations for the program, such as Burundians in Tanzania, the Eritrean Kanuma in Ethiopia, as well as vulnerable Congolese in Burundi. The humanitarian resettlement program in Vietnam, for those who were unable to apply for the orderly departure program, is now underway. And the first people accorded status under this program arrived in the United States in September, in this month. While the international community is making some, although slow, progress in achieving agreement on durable solutions for the 106,000 Bhutanese in Nepal, having had several meetings on this, I'm very hopeful that the coming year will end what has been a decade-long stalemate and produce concrete results with this population. The program continues to target diverse populations of refugees throughout the world. We are on track to admit about 41,200 refugees this year, representing over 60 nationalities. Interagency cooperation has never been more important to the sustaining of this successful implementation of this program. The Refugee Corps at the Department of Homeland Security, Citizenship and Immigration Services is working closely with the Department of State to adjudicate applications of those that are provided access to our program in more than 50 locations around the globe. We continue to lead the world in refugee resettlement, accepting over 60% of the individuals referred by UNHCR in 2005 and admitting more refugees each year than all the rest of the world combined. Through multilateral and bilateral efforts and bilateral representations, we have been able to support UNHCR in promoting the expansion of countries that are engaged in resettlement. Brazil, Chile, Argentina, Spain, Ireland, and the United Kingdom are some of the nations that have joined in this important humanitarian work in recent years. We also continue to enhance UNHCR's ability to identify and refer refugees for resettlement by working with them to ensure that field offices have the resources that are necessary for them to carry out this important work. Our collaboration with NGOs is a critical part of our program. We have solicited and received ideas and benefited from the research of NGO colleagues regarding resettlement needs and priorities. We have also implemented a mechanism to allow NGOs engaged in refugee assistance overseas to refer compelling cases directly to us. I'm also pleased to report that, having overcome some significant obstacles this year, We admitted the first 9 North Korean refugees since the passage of the Human Rights Act. While we expect that most North Koreans seeking refuge will continue to resettle in the Republic of Korea, we are very happy to be contributing to this humanitarian effort and are working diligently to ensure that more will be admitted here in the coming year. It is clear that the program has felt the impact of post-September 11th expansions in the scope of terrorism-related inadmissibility provisions of the Immigration and Nationality Act. As a result, the Departments of State, Homeland Security, and Justice have been engaged in efforts to exercise the inapplicability provision contained in the INA. This means that these amendments do not apply to refugee applications of individuals who pose no security threat to the United States and that we would otherwise want to admit. In consultation with the Secretary of Homeland Security and the Attorney General, the Secretary of State has twice invoked what has been referred to as the inapplicability authority. That is the authority not to apply to particular groups of individuals, the INA provision that bars those who provide material support to groups that are deemed terrorist organizations under the vast expansion of the definition in the law. The exercise of the inapplicability authority benefited Burmese Karen refugees in Thailand who supported groups that share U.S. goals and pose no security threat to the U.S. And we continue to review other populations for similar consideration and expect that additional refugees will benefit from the use of this authority in the near future. Unfortunately, the inapplicability provision does not address other meritorious cases, such as Cuban anti-Castro freedom fighters, Vietnamese Montagnards who fought alongside of U.S. forces, and Karen, who participated in resistance against brutal attacks on their families and friends by the Burmese regime. The administration is working on developing a solution to address these groups. The president's FY07 budget request would support 70,000 admissions, and we urge Congress to fund the president's full request. Without a healthy appropriation, we will be unable to offer resettlement to thousands of refugees who are in desperate need of our help. The refugee resettlement program is an enormously important foreign policy tool. Its use can also promote acceptance of other durable solutions, such as repatriation and local integration. We are doing our best to ensure that the program is flexible and that we provide access to refugees for whom resettlement is the appropriate solution. It is the administration's view that important national security concerns and counterterrorism efforts are compatible with our historic role as the world's leader in refugee resettlement. We will continue to seek opportunities to strengthen these two important policy interests. We look forward to working with you and other concerned members of the Senate and House to restore the necessary balance between national security concerns and our nation's legacy as a refuge for the persecuted. The United States Refugee Admissions Program has always been and remains a wonderful reflection of who we are as Americans, generous, compassionate, and immensely proud of our cultural diversity. As President Bush said, and I quote, "All who live in tyranny and hopelessness can know the United States will not ignore your oppression or excuse your oppressors. When you stand for your liberty, we will stand with you." Thank you for your continued support of this very important program. I look forward to answering your questions.
Thank you, Madam Secretary. Thank you for that testimony and for your service. Mr. Sharfin, we'd be glad to hear any opening statements you might care to make.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Kennedy. I'm honored to have this opportunity to discuss the President's proposal for refugee admissions in fiscal year 2007. U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services enthusiastically supports the proposed ceiling of 70,000 refugee admissions for the upcoming fiscal year. We are committed to providing the staff and resources to meet the goals outlined in the annual report to Congress on refugee admissions. As part of the Department of Homeland Security, USCIS has responsibility for interviewing applicants for refugee resettlement, adjudicating their applications, and ensuring that necessary security checks are fully performed. For the first time this fiscal year, members of the newly formed Refugee Corps fulfilled this role for the USCIS. The establishment of the Refugee Corps is a major success for the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program as a whole, and USCIS in particular. Today, we have nearly 30 refugee officers on board, with others in the hiring pipeline. We are very grateful to members of this committee and this subcommittee for your steadfast support for this initiative from its conception to reality. USCIS is dedicated to preserving and promoting our national security. At the same time, we are deeply committed to continuing to provide protection to deserving refugees around the world and to upholding our tradition as a nation of immigrants. Due to national security imperatives, legislation passed in recent years greatly expanded the definition of terrorist activity and terrorist organizations for purposes of determining which foreign nationals may be admitted to this country. The legislative initiatives included a provision making aliens who provide material support to individuals or organizations that emerge in terrorist activity inadmissible to the United States. The broad language of this terrorist activity provision in the Immigration and Nationality Act has had an impact on refugee admissions this year. However, the two recent exercises of the discretionary exemption authority contained in the INA by Secretary of Rice for Burmese Karen refugees living in certain camps in Thailand show that the intra-agency process is capable of successfully addressing these challenging issues. For USCIS's part, we consider the first exercise of Secretary Rice's material support exemption authority for ethnic Karen Burmese refugees in Tom Hin Camp in Thailand to have been very successful. Our refugee officers who worked in the Tom Hin Camp were able to explore all relevant facts and recommend sound decisions on the eligibility of refugee applicants on a case-by-case basis. We continue to work on an intra-agency basis to consider other groups that may be good candidates for future exercises of exemption authority. USCIS is committed to a strong partnership with its federal, international, and non-governmental partners to support a robust U.S. refugee resettlement program. We are equally committed to ensuring the integrity of our adjudications process. As such, we collaborate with our partners, including law enforcement and national security colleagues and international and non-governmental organizations, to achieve our common objective, offering refuge to some of the most threatened populations around the world while continuing to ensure the security of those who offer this refuge, the American people. I would be happy to respond to any questions you may have. As one note, I would like to add is that just recently we got word regarding our term employees, and if you're interested in asking questions about that, gentlemen, I'll be ready to talk about a USCIS employee, term employees issue that I know both of you have been very interested in. Thank you very much. I look forward to your questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Sharp, and rather than hold us in suspense, why don't you tell us about it?
Yes, sir.
I know this is a subject matter of some concern. Senator Kennedy and myself are meeting with you and Secretary Sabre and Secretary Rice. Could you fill us in?
Yes, sir. Just last evening, we received word from the Office of Personnel Management that USCIS would have the authority to extend the employment of the term employees that we had working for USCIS. As you know, this is a matter of both an authority and resources. What we have now is the authority to extend these terms. It's our intention to extend terms of the term employees until at least January 31st of 2007. This would affect 350 term employees, additional employees, and that's a rough calculation that we just did today, so that's an approximation, but that's our intent. We'll have to then take a look at our internal funding. As you know, we're a fee-funded organization, and we'll have to be making some shifts in our funds to be able to pay for those employees, but that's our intention, and we will do that.
What would have been the consequences of failure to extend this term
I think we were concerned that we would lose some valuable experience and very good employees who are important for us to the USCIS in being able to maintain our current workload. And all projections are is that our workload will either remain steady or increase.
With the Senator, just you, what was the reduction of backlog? You reduced that backlog of cases. As I haven't got the figures here, but I think it was something like 2.5 million down to.
Yes, sir.
It was still significant, but at least it was dramatic.
It was dramatic, yes, sir. At one point in the year 2004, we had a backlog of 3.8 million, and we have reduced that backlog now to.
In terms of people waiting, I mean, that meant that the individuals and families were going to be waiting for a very considerable period of time, 18 months.
Yes, sir.
Even longer.
That's correct, sir. And the term employees were key to reducing that backlog and, as you point out, reducing that long wait list. We have not achieved that 6-month goal in all categories, but we have in many.
Well, I know the president's goal is to, and your goal is to bring that down to no longer than 6 months. And I think if there hadn't been the extension of the term allowing you to maintain these employees, it might have proven the maxim I've heard in some quarters that no good deed goes unpunished. But in this instance, a good deed has been rewarded by providing the additional means to keep these term employees on there, continue to work down the backlog. As Senator Kennedy and I have worked, as have all our colleagues, on immigration-related issues, and we all know that your workload is going to do nothing but increase.
Yes, sir.
And we don't know exactly how or in what respects, but I think it's a virtual certainty that we're going to have to provide adequate resources through citizenship and immigration services to process the large number of people that are going to need your services.
Yes, sir, and I'd be remiss not to point out that it took a lot of interest both within the executive branch and the legislative branch. Over 5 years, we received appropriations. We received the authority to hire the term employees, and without that, we wouldn't have reduced the backlog. And so that was always appreciated.
Secretary Sabre, we've talked a little bit about really the challenges that the State Department, the Department of Homeland Security, have in meeting the 70,000 cap that has been authorized. And, of course, what has been mentioned is the definition of terrorist activity that bars the relocation or resettlement of those who have either been combatants, who have been members of terrorist organizations as defined, or those who provided material support. But it strikes me that looking at the numbers that this definition and this these bars cannot alone account for our inability to meet that 70,000 cap. Could you expand just a little bit on what you believe the other factors are that are impeding resettlement up to that cap?
Certainly, Senator. Appreciate the opportunity to do so. First of all, last year we were funded not for 70,000 but for 54,000. And our plan was based on the expectation of bringing in 54,000. We're actually bringing in, as I said, 41,200. Most of the difference really has been because of the implications of material support. However, there are other factors, and I think perhaps Senator Kennedy referenced the large number of refugees around the world. And so we sometimes are asked, well, why don't you just go find some other refugees? And indeed, we are looking for other caseloads that are not problematic. But we do make decisions based on vulnerability, and decisions are made well in advance of the time that a refugee actually arrives in the United States. The time that it takes from the identification of a caseload, working with the government, getting agreement that they will allow UNHCR to do camp registration. For example, right now we have finally achieved agreement from Nepal to do to allow UNHCR to begin registering those Bhutanese refugees, which is hopefully a first step towards addressing this protracted situation. But my point being that it takes a long time to work through the process, getting them registered, going through the various security issues, DHS interviews, health processing, and so forth. So when material support hit us last year and affected, we had anticipated 9,400 refugees in the Tom Hin camp. It was part of our resettlement program for this year. We had anticipated bringing the majority, if not all, of those to the United States. That population was largely disappeared. In addition, there are situations where countries such as Cuba decide to make it difficult for refugees that are processed and do not issue exit permits. So it's a combination of these sorts of factors that that interfered. But the two big ones are funding and material support.
Is it true that there is an unallocated reserve over and above just the funding issue, which is a big issue, and we need to work, we need to do better in Congress to meet those funding issues so that we can get closer to the cap. But is there an unallocated reserve kept in order to deal with unexpected emergencies, the natural disasters and the like?
Well, in this year's plan, we've identified a 50,000 number, and we have an unallocated reserve of the additional 20,000, and that was, frankly, in anticipation of material support waivers that would allow us to increase significantly, we hope, the numbers of Burmese refugees. But yes, we can modify the program during the year to meet unexpected situations.
And certainly, I think Congress is capable of dealing with emergency situations that might result in an unexpected increase due to natural disasters or the like. But obviously, you have a challenging job. Let me ask you, Madam Secretary, the United States, of course, accepts more refugees than any other country. In fact, the United States accepts more than 60% of the individuals referred by the United Nations High Commissioner, and that is something we are all justly proud of. But what's the Department of State and the United Nations High Commissioner doing to encourage other countries to make refugee resettlement a high priority?
I will be next week in Geneva trying to do exactly that, because the UNHCR Executive Committee will be meeting. We are currently funding a program in Latin America to try to build capacity on the part of three Latin American countries that have recently indicated willingness to accept refugees. And we are trying to help them to develop their ability to process and to have a resettlement program. We are constantly working with other countries to encourage them to join in this effort or increase the number of refugees that they are accepting. There really are only two countries that accept any large numbers besides the U.S., and they are very small by contrast, are Australia and Canada. Most of the other countries take numbers in the hundreds. And so there is a lot of work to do to try to get other countries to step up to the plate.
Mr. Sheriff, and let me ask you, you talked a little bit about the Refugee Corps,
the men and women who go out and help adjudicate these cases. And, of course, we know they're required to make difficult and complex decisions. For example, they have to determine whether refugee applicants have persecuted other individuals. What role did these individuals play in administering the material support waiver to refugees in the camp in Thailand? And can you share with us what you learned from that experience?
Yes, sir. We did send our members, the USCIS members who did go to the Tom Hin camp to process the Karen refugees. We're from our refugee corps. We sent five of the members there, and their experience was a good experience. They felt that they were able to apply the inapplicability provisions well in those circumstances, that the standards and criteria were clear to them. The process that was set up there with both the NGOs and the State Department worked well, and that they were trained well before they went. The USCIS provided training with the State Department and others here in Washington prior to going to the Tom Hin camp. Once there, the Refugee Corps felt that the experience from start to finish was good. Approximately 80% of those interviewed qualified for refugee status. They were able to apply the inapplicability provisions to approximately 30% of that population. And overall, they thought that the interagency process leading up to the trip to Tom Hin was good. It provided them clear guidance, and they were well prepared to exercise their responsibilities there in Tom Hin. And they're looking forward to going off to Thailand for this next set as well.
Let me ask one last question, and then I'll turn it over to Senator Kennedy, Secretary Sabre. Some have suggested that the State Department needs additional authority. But I want to know from you whether you and perhaps Secretary Rice, I know we talked about this some informally at our meeting that Senator Kennedy and I mentioned earlier, but whether you believe that the waiver authority given to the Secretary that has been used effectively, it sounds, whether that provides sufficient flexibility to deal with the issue.
As I indicated in my testimony, Senator, the waiver authority has certainly helped a great deal. It does not cover all individuals. For example, in Tom Hin, about 1,000 are on hold because they are either members of a group or identified as combatants.
Okay.
So
the waiver just deals with material support.
The waiver only addresses
and not combatants
support.
or members. And that's are you suggesting that waiver authority needs to be expanded?
This is a pretty difficult and complex issue because it involves a number of federal agencies that have different responsibilities. We have been working at an interagency level within the administration to try to find a solution, and will continue to do so.
Thank you very much. Senator Kennedy.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Madam Secretary, just to go over these figures just quickly, as I understand the administration request, first of all, let me acknowledge that there are some former refugees here in the audience, as I understand. They're from Somalia, Liberia, Sierra Leone, Romania, maybe other countries. They're now staff at the Lutheran Social Services for the National Capital Area. The Lutheran Refugee Program is recognized as being just one of the really very tops over the years. So I thank them for coming and thank them for their continuing commitment to the refugee community. And if they have concluded at the end of the day, have some ideas or suggestions, or we'd certainly welcome having whatever comments that they'd like to make. I think I'm sure I speak for our chairman and Senator Brownback, but we've got staff here, and we'd love to get them, and we'll try and give them to them personally. Madam Secretary, just to quickly on the figures, the administration requested 893, and you got 783. And it was 893 was for 70,000, and then you got to 42,000 for the 783. That is there, so. Just looking at the numbers, it doesn't look quite the sort of fit in terms of the numbers. You know, if you're doing a proportionality. Is there a comment you'd like to make?
If I can comment on what we're looking at currently.
I was looking at this last year. We had authorized 70,000, we got 42,000, and one of the comments that you made was that the reduction of the Congress funding it. And as I understand it, the administration had requested 893 million for 70,000, and you got 783, but you only had 42,000, and it looks like this percentage wise is more of a drop there. I'm just interested in what your comment. If you want to submit it later on for the record on it, if there's a way of understanding it a little better.
Well, there are two parts to our funding. We have the assistance and protection portion, which is the greater portion of our funds go for the kinds of things, Mr. Chairman, that you talked about: food, water, sanitation, health. The admissions program is the smaller piece of our funding, and it was the admissions line that took the largest cut.
Okay. I'd be interested, just for the record, because that's one we want to keep an eye on. We want to try and be helpful to you. It would be. And maybe Mr. Sheffrin, I was interested, how did you get from the Marines into this work? Quickly, I have my time watcher over here, Senator Brownback. No, just kidding, but could you give us a minute or two on that?
Yes, sir.
I commend you for it. I mean, it's obviously commitment to public service and the country.
Right. Thank you. Both my mom and dad were career public servants. I was stationed my last tour. I was detailed as an active duty Marine colonel to the Clinton administration National Security Council. I then stayed on through the transition and stayed on with President Bush's administration as the, in both instances, as a deputy legal advisor to the National Security Council. From there, I retired. And Mr. Hyde, we had been working on different pieces of legislation over the years and in my capacity at the NSC, and he saw fit to offer me a position there.
Well, good for you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Let me ask you about what DHS do to correct the problem to allow, you know, bona fide refugees to come to the U.S. And what I'm interested in is if you can provide us with a list of the groups that Homeland Security has determined are undesignated terrorist organization, and explain the administrative review process that led to those determinations. I mean, and does DHS consult closely with the intelligence community and other agencies to determine whether a group is an undesignated terrorist organization? If you want to provide that later on, or you can summarize it now.
Yes, sir. It's an interagency process that does involve the intelligence agencies, the State Department, but I would feel more confident providing that to you in writing after this hearing.
I think this is a part of the nub. You know, we are talking about waivers and talking about legislation and talking about the kind of coordination. I think you've got the drift from the chairman and myself about our, you know, the interest that we have. I think we've gotten some good answers today and helpful answers, but I think if we get some accountability in these areas, because this material support doesn't only apply to the refugees, it also applies to the asylum applicants as well. And as I understand, there are 500 or so asylum applicants that are there, that this applies to. So
that's correct.
These are people that may very well be in real considerable danger.
Yes, sir. And those applications have been put on hold pending resolution of those issues, sir.
so they're not required. They don't go back. I think one of the points we want to get to is we don't. We've got the designation for next year. We're going to struggle and fight for the resources, and then we don't want to come back and next year and find the same kinds of, you know, sort of the challenges and problems that we've lost the opportunity to reach those numbers. I mean, that's in the back of our head, at least mine, too. So we want to try and avoid it. And I think any suggestions and recommendations that you have that can help us on that, I'd very much appreciate.
Yes, sir.
Let me mention issue on what we call the P3s. These are the reunifications of the family. You know, the family reunification. I don't know whether I had that right here. The family reunifications. So here we go. We have, at the present time, the administration has a list of 17 nationalities to be eligible for the P3 designation. That's the ability to bring in their children and the families. This is a big aspect of our immigration overall policy, is the family. And we've dealt with these, trying to get it into the nuclear family, when you have the abuses on the immigration issues. But that certainly in bringing in children and immediate members of the families are a priority, and yet it doesn't apply. I don't know why we have to have a P3 category. Why it isn't available to all groups? Myself, I don't understand that. Maybe there's a good reason for it. The UN High Commission and U.S. refugee agencies have urged the State Department to create a universal application of P3. Now, this year, you have the department take Ivory Coast, Togo, and Liberia off the P3 designation list. You know, what is the story?
It's really State Department.
I think that issue, I might defer to Madam Secretary to answer the taking that country off the list, sir.
We feel very strongly about family reunification, and it is indeed a major goal in our program. We ran into a situation in Liberia where, because of great changes in Liberia, there was great hope, and most of the effort of all of the refugee program is to enable people to go home. We think most people really want to go home. What we were encountering was, because of the P3 opportunity for resettlement for a small number, there were a lot of people that were waiting and not going home. So we were actually asked in that case by UNHCR, as well as the government, interested parties.
Are you saying they had big, big families all of a sudden? Is that what you're...
No, what I'm saying is that because of the P3 and... Believe me, there's not a whole lot of understanding when we are doing refugee, when DHS-CIS is there doing refugee resettlement adjudication. There's not a whole lot of understanding about who qualifies. So there were a lot of people who were simply sitting in the camp, missing the opportunity to go home because they were thinking that this P3 adjudication process was going to allow them to be resettled to the United States. So we set a time where we allowed the continuing of the filing of the forms that would make them eligible, and we will restart the P3 resettlement process, I believe, in January. But we wanted to create a window that would allow those that needed to be thinking about repatriating to Liberia to proceed to do so.
Well, I'm just interested generally why we have that designation. We're talking about spouses, and we're talking about unmarried children under 21, older parents in some circumstances. And it's never made, I never could quite understand why we do permit that if we're having the refugees for some countries and we don't do it for others. And why we, I really have a difficult time understanding it. And I'd hope that maybe they go back and take a look at it. The UN High Commission has made the recommendations, the various voluntary agencies have made it made these recommendations, and I've never really heard at least a convincing argument to me why some countries should have that and other countries not. But if you could just take another look at that, I'd very much appreciate it. I know my time is just about up. Could I ask just a moment about Darfur? If we have any, an overwhelming humanitarian kind of problem, it's a little different from what we have looked at and what our jurisdiction generally in terms of refugees. But if there's anything, if the chairman would just permit, if you could give us any kind of hope on this situation and give us some idea about any ways that we obviously can be helpful.
This is a little bit out of my department, but let me just say I know that the State Department continues to work diligently to try to get acceptance for a UN force to come in. In the meantime, however, we have seen huge refugee flows into Chad, as well as internally displaced persons in Darfur. We are committed, my office, along with others in the State Department, have committed very large resources to protection and assistance. One of our great concerns is the attacks that are happening with high frequency now on humanitarian workers. And one point I would like to make is, if there's something I've learned very quickly in this position, it's to have tremendous respect for the people on the ground who are providing under very dangerous circumstances for the well-being of refugees and internally displaced persons. We are not able at this point to even be thinking about a resettlement program because UNHCR simply, it's a very dangerous environment, and UNHCR does not have the capacity, nor do we, to go in and try to do processing. But it's certainly going to be an issue for the future.
I thank the chair.
Thank you, Senator Kennedy. We've been joined by Senator Brownback, who's former chairman of this subcommittee and who I know has a lot of interest and expertise in this subject, and recently traveled to refugee camps in Africa, I understand. And Senator Brownback, we'll turn the floor over to you.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I don't know about the expertise, but I do have a lot of interest in it, and I appreciate you holding this hearing and appreciate Senator Kennedy's long-term interest in this topic for many, many years that he's worked on it. I appreciate that, and people on his staff, Esther, as I know, worked on this a lot as well, and I appreciate all that effort and focus and intensity. Thanks very much for being here. I want to start off thanking you and applauding you for your twice exercising discretionary authority on the Karen refugee population, bringing some of those residing in that camp. I visited that refugee camp, I guess it was 2001, and they certainly need every bit of help that we can give. I hope you can continue to do that. This is a group that's stateless, that's has predators all around it on traffickers for young girls in particular, and they really need our help, and they don't have another option. Place to go. So to the degree you can continue to help them out, I would appreciate that. And I also want to thank you for admitting the first refugees under the North Korean Human Rights Act, bringing some refugees into the country here. Having said that, I think the first group was like nine from North Korea, and the numbers I have seen or heard about, and I don't know if anybody can verify any of these at all, but that you're looking at somewhere between 200,000 and 300,000 North Korean refugees in northern China, stateless. A number of the women, the reports I'm getting, almost all of the women are trafficked, sold into some form of sexual bondage in China. There's another generation of children now coming up in that situation where they're having children, and these children are also stateless and subject to the vagrancies and the difficulties of being in that situation. And I'm hopeful we can admit a lot more North Korean refugees into the United States. I don't know if you have any thoughts that you can give about either of those population pools.
Thank you, Senator. I just came back from visiting the Tom Hin camp in Thailand. tremendously overcrowded, huge, huge problems there. Visited one of the other more remote camps as well. It certainly brings a driving compassion to wanting to help these people through resettlement, which is really the only option. They can't go back to Burma. They are stateless, as you said. And Thailand, while it's been a generous host for almost 20 years for this population, is not willing to allow them to assimilate. So the only option is resettlement. And we are eagerly looking forward to expanding the resettlement program to other camps in Thailand, as well as to hopefully being able to close out the Tom Hin population in the next year, to the degree that we can resolve some of the problems that we've encountered in trying to do so. As far as the North Koreans, as you know, this presents very unique challenges because the huge number of them are in the PRC. The PRC does not recognize them as refugees. They refer to them as migrants, economic migrants. I've had meetings. I was in Beijing about 2 months ago and had meetings with the Chinese at that time to urge them, number one, not to send North Koreans back to North Korea, where they may be persecuted and tortured. Secondly, to try to get the PRC to work more cooperatively with us for those that are in the PRC and indicating an interest in resettlement in the U.S. The other countries in the region that the North Koreans reach, as you know, this is a very sensitive issue. There's a great concern about creating a huge pull factor. So we don't talk publicly.
Kim Jong-il has already created a great pull factor, or a push factor, I guess, on his part.
There's no question, but I would be very happy to talk in a more classified setting about the efforts that we are making with other countries in the region, but we don't talk about that publicly because of the sensitivity and the issues of trying to get cooperation. But we will continue to work to try to bring additional North Koreans here. It's a high priority for the president as well as for my bureau and the State Department.
I look at that, and particularly the PRC has been very difficult to deal with on this. I've met with them, the administration officials have met with them about the refoulement that they are doing of North Korean refugees. That has created then this trafficking situation, because women come across the line. They're actually, and I'm even told this, that some of the houses along the border, the owners have dogs to bark for when people come by to see if it's a female North Korean that they can capture and sell. They're captured like wild animals and sold for value. But then the women, once they're cold, they're caught, they're told, you will do as I say, or I'm turning you into the Chinese authority. They're sending you back to North Korea, and you know what that means. That means you're going into the gulag. And you know what happens there. And then they comply, and then the person, the Chinese man that buys them, tells them the same story. You're going to do what I say, and if you don't, I'm turning you into the Chinese authority. They're shipping you back to North Korea. You're going to the gulag, and you know what happens there. And so that this very situation of refoulement, where China does not comply with its own international obligations, creates this entire trafficking pool of hundreds of thousands that are in. And I think it's past time for us talking to the Chinese. I think it's time for us to start talking about economic sanctions on them for violating their own agreements on with the UNHCR. That we should do a type of approach where if you're going to continue to refoul, then we're going to put forward systems where we can tax you and hit you economically on this. If you're going to continue to violate this in such a way that these people are being persecuted and killed, I hope the administration can join us on this. I know the president's deeply concerned about it. I would note one final thing, because my time's way over. Appreciate the 70,000 number, but we just We've been averaging bringing in 41,000 refugee admissions the past 4 years. We're not coming close to those numbers, and from what I've seen and the people I've talked to, there's no shortage of refugees around the world that we wouldn't be hitting these numbers. And I would really urge you to redouble your efforts. I know it's difficult. I know we have a lot of security concerns to watch for, but there are huge populations that are absolutely persecuted and have no other option. And it gives them hope, and it makes us a better place. As these people are resettled in the United States, I've hosted the North Korean refugees. They tell incredible stories, but it's an incredible story of human courage. And their persecution is like just a direct hit into our system of saying, well, we ought to stand up for people that are in troubling circumstances. And the more people they can talk to, the more people they motivate. It's a blessing to us. And I really hope we can do more to do that and get more individuals in the United States, if for no other reason than for our own benefit here. Thanks for your work. Godspeed in it. I think we need to do more, and particularly in some of these targeted populations that are in a horrific circumstance.
Thank you, Senator. I appreciate everything that you have said and share your passion about it, and just hope that the Senate mark, on which is the President's request, will be what we're working with next year. As I indicated before you came in, Senator, we were only funded for 54,000, despite the fact that the President had asked for 70. And this year, the Senate has a mark of that will allow us to reach the President's goal, in addition to the fact that we now have the inapplicability provision for the Karen. This gives us great optimism that with these two things in place that we can indeed increase our numbers significantly.
I hope you hit the number, because as an appropriator, when I see money appropriated and then if it's appropriated for 70,000 or even 54,000 and you only hit 41,000, I'm thinking, well, I've got some money I can put somewhere else now.
You need to
hit the number and use it, or it's going to be shifted somewhere, because people are always, tracking for where can we move money around in this budget. That's the nature of what happens here.
Had we not encountered the problem of material support this year, I think we would have reached our number of 54 that we were funded for. So now we hope that next year, because we do have the waivers for the camps in Thailand, that this will expand the pull that we have already got in the pipeline. So we hope that we can count on the funding to be able to reach the numbers.
Thanks, Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Brownback. And let me extend my thanks to both of you again for being here today and for your service to the nation and to people truly in need. Thank you very much. Yeah. We'll now move to the next panel, please. Father Gavin and Mr. Horowitz, thank you for being here today and for contributing to our knowledge on this important topic. Let me first introduce Mr. Horowitz, who will be the first member of the second panel. He's a senior fellow and director at the Hudson Institute for Civil Justice Reform and Project for International Religious Liberty. Mr. Horowitz served as general counsel for the Office of Management and Budget from 1981 to 1985. and as an associate professor of law at the University of Mississippi from 1965 to 1967. He served as chairman of President Reagan's Domestic Policy Council on Federalism and was co-chairman of the Cabinet's Council Working Group on Legal Tort Policy. We also have with us today Father Kenneth Gavin. Father Gavin serves as the National Director of the Jesuit Refugee Service, USA, in addition to serving as Vice Chair of the Refugee Council, USA. Father Gavin has also served on the boards of numerous Catholic educational and service organizations. He has a Ph.D. in speech pathology from Northwestern University, a Master's of Divinity from Weston School of Theology, a Master's of Art in Linguistics from the State University of New York, and last but not least, an A.B. from Fordham University. Gentlemen, thank you for being with us today. Mr. Horowitz, let me turn to you first for any opening statement that you would care to give. And let me remind you to punch that little button at the bottom of your microphone. And if the light comes on, that means your microphone's working.
Thank you, Senator Cornyn. I'm sorry Senator Kennedy isn't here because I wanted to start off by saying I'm a Marine also. And except that I only made it to Lance Corporal E3. I never got to Colonel as the prior witness. And I think that's relevant because there's a lot of mock macho that does go on here on some of these immigration issues that I hope to address today, that I hope that this committee and many senators will correct. I've been a frequent witness before Congress. I've never been more pleased to testify than I am today because of the symbolic and the real importance of the issue before this committee. We've heard Secretary Sabri say that she hasn't met her target largely because of the construction, the so-called material assistance issue and problem. Let me describe what it is. First, there is the determination made that, to take a particular example, members of the Hmong and Montagnard communities, no matter that they prove themselves eligible for refugee status on every ground, no matter that they are vetted individually on grounds of whether they will support terrorism, they have been involved in terrorism, have committed crimes, they pass every test with flying colors, and they are deemed terrorists per se solely because their community fought on the side of the United States in the Vietnam War. Now, I don't believe that that construction is remotely called for under the statutes that Congress passed. But the fact of the matter is that there is that waiver authority, and we've seen it exercised in the case of the Karams, a very narrow band of them. This has gone on for 2 years, Mr. Chairman, and it's inexcusable that members who fought and died on the side of United States troops are deemed terrorists, no matter how, and excluded from the United States simply because they took our side. That surely is no way to enhance the national security of the United States. And Secretary Sabri indicated, and we know, that there is clear authority, at least in some cases, to waive that for people who've given material support. I was troubled to hear Secretary Sabri say that it's complex and difficult to have get administration support for the what I would regard as a technical amendment, because once again the position that Ms. Sabri says is complex is one that says that if you gave aid to the troops fighting on the side of the United States in Vietnam, why then we can waive you in and not exclude you no matter what else. No matter what other qualities you bring. But if you lifted a rifle and engaged in combat, risking your life on the side of United States troops, well, we need a statutory amendment, and it's a very complicated matter. I don't think it is a complicated matter, Senator. And I think, and I hope that the senators, and particularly conservative senators, will hold the administration's feet to the fire on that issue. And now we get to the second issue, the so-called duress issue. We have case after case of people who paid ransoms because terrorists came in their community, stuck guns to the head of their children and threatened to rape them. And they paid modest ransoms. They are regarded as terrorists. And once again, they meet the test of refugees in every single particular. They pass every known test of whether or not they pose any security problems to the United States, whether they've associated with terrorists, whether they've committed crimes in their own countries. There's a whole host of tests, and there ought to be tests, particularly after 9/11, on an individual case. But what we have here is a per se determination that says the facts be damned. We don't care how qualified you are as a refugee. If you paid a ransom to stop your wife from getting shot, you are a terrorist. Now, I don't believe that the Congress of the United States passed legislation that posed a test that every single member of Congress would have failed. I think the Supreme Court has made clear in a number of cases, to cite the Bailey decision, where given the circumstances, where reasonable men must concede that they too would not have been able to act otherwise, a duress exception, defense, is implicit in the law. And yet the administration has refused to allow this. So that victims of terrorism are regarded as terrorists, or to take the case of groups, as a letter from the Jewish community said, under the administration's definition, people who fought in Warsaw against the Nazis would be regarded as terrorists, inadmissible to the United States, whatever other virtues they had. So I say, I don't think we need to change the law, but if one reads the law as Secretary Sabri does, why have we waited for 2 years to give that same kind of exception to Montagnards, to Cubans, and to others that we've reluctantly given in a narrow band to the Karen? But the matter is even worse than that, Mr. Chairman, because when I discovered that this was going on, to my utter astonishment, I could not believe, because I do support and love the president and know where he comes from on these issues, that this was a position taken by the administration. I sat down with the refugee groups. There is, as you know, legislation from conservatives, from Congressman Pitts. There is there is Senate legislation to deal with this anomaly, to deal with this issue. But we all know what getting legislation passed at the end of session is like. And so I looked to see if there weren't administrative solutions that could resolve, for the most part, all of these problems. And it turned out there were. And I worked with the immigrant groups, and then I called up colleagues, former colleagues, friends of mine in the administration. I said, how do you justify not holding hearings for 2 years on Montagnards to give them the waiver? And they said, we really can't. So what we did was put in an administrative determination that there will be a timely procedure for holding these hearings and determinations for waivers of groups that are not terrorists, that are freedom fighters, that would never be listed as terrorists by the government in any other context. And then we got to the duress problem. I said, what's your problem? How can you deem a person to be a terrorist who simply paid a ransom to avoid the death of a spouse? Or we have the case of women who were repeatedly raped and who washed the clothes of the terrorists who raped them. They are denied refugee status. We have the case. I said, how can you possibly do it? They said, well, the first problem is there is no definition of terrorism. It's of duress. It's too loose. So I sat down with the refugee groups, and you'll see it, Mr. Chairman, in one of the attachments here, entitled Administrative Proposal. And the refugee groups agreed to a definition that said that the applicant must show that he or she was faced with what a reasonable person would deem a threat of death or serious bodily harm. And they went further. They said that the applicant, even if they had the threat of bodily harm, that the applicant must show that he or she acted necessarily and reasonably to avoid the threat. And they went further and said that there must be a finding that the person that the fact finder must affirmatively determine that the refugee will not threaten the security of the United States. I said, is that a tight enough definition? Well, I said, maybe it is. But we got another problem. We don't trust, they told me confidentially, some of these fact finders. They might just ignore the definition and give duress exceptions for these people. We went back to the drawing board. I said, and the refugee and the immigrant groups have proposed a stroke of the pen administrative solution that says that if a finding of duress is made, that it must be, before it takes effect, reviewed on a timely basis by the Home Office at DHS. Every single security concern raised by the administration on the duress issue, which I think is built into the statute, I believe we've satisfied, and still there are some within the administration dragging their feet. And I will tell you, Senator, I've talked confidentially to members of the administration who are as upset as I am by the foot dragging that's taken place. And one of the reasons I'm so pleased to be at the hearing today is because I think United States senators have the capacity to raise this issue at the level of the president. And I have no doubt whatever as to the decision the president would make on this administrative procedure or necessary changes in order to permit Montagnards and Hmong to come to the United States or to allow victims of terrorism not to be barred because they were victims of terrorism when they met every other test for a refugee. In the case of the Hmong, I found that there are...
Horwitz, let me ask you to wind down your opening statement and we can get some questions and answers.
You bet. There are many other things I think that can be said here, but I would simply say that as a conservative, this approach caricatures kind of tough approaches that you have taken on many other issues and related issues. And I think it's incumbent on those of us who really want a robust policy dealing with the aftermath of 9/11 to fight the hardest to take out policies of this kind, which are facts be damned, blanket misuse of statute, in order to deny refugee status to otherwise fully qualified people. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Horwitz. Father Gavin, we'd be glad to hear from you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for this opportunity to testify as Vice Chair of Refugee Council USA and as National Director of Jesuit Refugee Service USA. Refugee Council USA, as you know, is a coalition of 23 non-governmental organizations dedicated to refugee protection. I have with me a copy of our annual report for this year, and I ask at this time that it be entered into the record, if possible.
Certainly, without objection.
Thank you. I'm speaking today on behalf of my own organization, as well as the agencies in Refugee Council USA, who help resettle the majority of refugees that the United States admits each year. In this testimony, I'll make logistical points about how the U.S. refugee program can be made more effective. But before I move on to statistics, I simply like to reflect on the reality of the people affected by the program itself. Fear, hopelessness, and death are the options that most refugees face. I saw firsthand in Malaysia the year before last, where I met with Chin refugees who had fled from severe religious persecution at the hands of the Burmese government. After fleeing to Malaysia, these refugees found themselves in an equally precarious situation. Many of the 15,000 Chin in Malaysia live in sordid plywood hovels in the shadow of the splendid rising city of Putrajaya, a city that they've helped to build with their own blood and sweat. As refugees, they now suffer abuse and threats at the hands of local police and unscrupulous employers. These refugees told me that their only hope for new lives lies in resettlement and a fresh start in a new country. Those of us who work with refugees know that each unfilled admission slot represents one person who needlessly continues to suffer because of our failures to offer a new home and a new life through resettlement. In this fiscal year, only 42,000 refugees are likely to be admitted to the United States, leaving more than 28,000 admission slots unfilled.
Refugee Council USA has consistently called for a target of 90,000 admissions in the refugee program. There are many contributing factors to this devastating shortfall in the admissions numbers. The most ominous obstacle, as we have heard, for the refugee program is the material support inadmissibility bar, which has prevented thousands of deserving refugees from seeking protection in the United States. As my written testimony reflects, the Refugee Council USA community calls for a legislative solution to refine the statute of the material support bar. Too many refugees have been unjustly labeled as willful collaborators with terrorists rather than being justly recognized as the victims of terrorism. Too many refugees have had their cases put on hold because they support groups who have incorrectly been categorized as terrorist organizations, and too little has been done to reach out to these twice persecuted people, as prolonged interagency negotiations over waivers prevent the administration from taking swift and effective action for the many populations affected by material support. Rather than depend on this cumbersome waiver process, we call for an amendment to the material support statute itself. With this legislative change, the law will promote safety for the United States and safety for bona fide refugees who come here seeking safe haven. Additional obstacles to a more successful U.S. refugee program can also be removed through procedural and policy reforms. The State Department can treat the annual presidential determination as a target rather than a ceiling, and it can make an effort to utilize the admissions numbers by lowering the number of rarely filled unallocated reserve positions. The State Department should also maintain at least a three-month pipeline of refugees moving towards admission to allow for unseen delays in refugee movements during the year. Steps can be taken to protect especially vulnerable refugee children and to include more priority two and priority three groupings. And all processing may be expedited, thus allowing the refugee program to admit more vulnerable refugees every year. In recent years, the President's budget request has failed to include sufficient funds to admit the number of refugees set by the presidential determination, and Congress has appropriated even less for refugee accounts. We recommend that the MRA account and the Office of Refugee Resettlement be funded at $980 million and $798 million, respectively, so that the refugee accounts do not continue to depend upon supplemental appropriations. All these changes should be made to increase the admissions numbers, which represent new lives for refugees by the thousands. The Chin in Malaysia deserve our help. They've dared to hope for a better future, and it's in our power to offer them new life and new hope through an improved U.S. refugee program. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Father Gavin, for your opening statement. Everyone who's spoken so far agrees with the goals of our refugee policy, and we've identified some problems that Congress perhaps needs to revisit in order to achieve those goals. But let me just drill down a little bit more, first starting with you, Mr. Horowitz, about some of your concerns. If the government has authority to waive material support, wouldn't that also include authority to cover duress, for example, the example you mentioned?
I don't think anyone denies that the government could create a duress defense on material support.
My question is, couldn't it be included in terms of a more, I won't call it a more expansive interpretation, but couldn't the, it seems to me that if you provide material support, you could do it under duress or you could do it voluntarily, but the term material support is broad enough to allow the secretary to use her waiver. Is that not correct?
Absolutely. I think when Congress passed it, it's inconceivable to me that when Congress passed the material support provision, I can't imagine that anybody thought that in Congress that material support involved paying a ransom when there was a gun to the head of your child, or you've been raped and imprisoned yourself and were forced to wash someone's clothes. That's simply done administratively within the administration. It's quite controversial within the administration, and I believe that if the Senate puts the wood to the administration and gets the issue directly to the president. And we've got, you've seen these letters, they've come from Gary Bauer and David Saperstein from the National Council of Churches and the Southern Baptist Convention. I've never seen such a grouping on an issue of this kind. I believe that the handful of people standing in the road saying no can be overridden. There are many in the administration hoping that you, Mr. Chairman, and your fellow members of the Senate will simply insist that a duress defense can be used. And I say again, the defense of duress does not excuse you from having to prove that you're a legitimate refugee or that you are not a threat to the United States to engage in terrorist activities on any other ground.
Father Gavin, you mentioned the a proposed change in the definitions that were first applied, I guess, in the Real ID Act of what constitutes a terrorist organization or terrorist activity. Particularly in when we are at war and we have, I think we would all agree, valid national security interest in making sure we protect America at the same time we try to implement a reasonable and rational refugee policy. Could you explain to me why you don't believe that your concerns could be addressed through perhaps an expanded waiver authority that maybe, to Mr. Horowitz's point, was more rationally applied in a way that it would achieve the goals that we all share?
Right. I think that it's important for us to say that the Refugee Council, of course, is not supporting support of terrorists in our country.
I did not understand you to say otherwise.
Well, what we really wish to do is to create a an interpretation and a legislation of material support that will allow terrorists to not enter our country, and yet allow all refugees who have a reasonable and valid right to be to the refugee resettlement program to enter. Our concern really with the current use of waivers for the material support issue is varied. To begin with, as we've all already heard, the complexity of interagency negotiations is something that obviously takes a good deal of time, and sometimes more than even a year or two to create. And although we applaud the use of waivers, we realize that these waivers are not going to be able to be used easily for large numbers of refugee populations in the coming years. Secondly, there are going to be individual cases of material support issue would apply to, and smaller groups that will be very difficult to be able to extend the waiver to just because of the complexity of time. Of course, then there are the issues of 20% of the Karen, 1,000 Karen in Tom Hin are not able at this point to pass the material support bar precisely because they served as combatants. There are 565 asylum cases here in the U.S. that are on hold precisely because of material support issues. The duress issue Mr. Horowitz has spoken to and I think is clear. For all those reasons, in addition to the complexity issue, we feel that simply fiddling with the waiver itself is not adequate, and that we have to move towards a legislative solution.
So far, we've heard, just to summarize, that there's an issue of unallocated reserve that I know you addressed, Father Gavin, in your written testimony, that the lack of funding, as well as the challenges of it, applying the law that Congress passed, barring those who provide material support to terrorist organizations. Let me ask you, Mr. Horowitz, are we doing enough to use our immigration and laws and policies as instruments and tools to advance our foreign policy and national security goals? I'm thinking in particularly the small number of North Korean refugees that, to use your words, their presence has vividly informed millions of Americans about the nature of the Kim Jong-il regime.
Senator, I'm here after taking the red eye back from meeting with the bravest people I've ever been in the same room with. These are in Los Angeles yesterday with leaders of the Korean-American community and leaders of the Underground Railroad movement. They have lots of ideas about what can be done and what to do. And I think there are many things that can be done. I will just raise one here. I think the UNHCR has gotten off a lot more easily than it ought to, at least in the case of North Korea. The North Korea Human Rights Act points to the fact that the UNHCR has the right to take China to binding international arbitration for its unlawful deportation of refugees. The UNHCR has not done so for fear of alienating China. I believe that we should be placing much greater pressure on the UNHCR to get at China, to take them to international arbitration, in order to increase the potential flow of North Korean refugees. One of the great keys is the UNHCR, and I think we ought to be taking tough tests with the new, with the incoming candidates for Secretary General of the United Nations to see that the UN takes a tougher position vis-a-vis China than it does. The UN, the North Korea Human Rights Act calls the failure to take China to arbitration by the UNHCR an abdication of its core responsibility. A second area is an amendment that this committee adopted, Ms. Chairman, the S-Visa exception, which says that if you can find, if people are prepared to defect with knowledge of weapons of mass destruction or terrorism from countries like North Korea, Iran, they and their families should get green cards. The administration has opposed such a provision, even though it was unanimously adopted by this committee. What Senator Brownback said about national interest here is, and I would echo it, if we can get 1,000 North Korean refugees in, that's it. We educate the people of the United States about the nature of the regime and encourage them to take steps like the blacks did in bringing down the apartheid regime, or like the Jewish community did under the leadership of Senator Jackson. They are precious assets for that reason. And while I think some of the administration have done well, I think we need to do a lot more in terms of American national interest.
You mentioned Iran. And the treatment of religious minorities there has, by all accounts, worsened considerably under President Ahmadinejad, who's expressed his wish, of course, to wipe Israel off the map, and who's repeatedly denied the Holocaust. Do you anticipate an increase in the departure of religious minorities from Iran to participate in the U.S. refugee program? And if so, can you talk a little bit about what you think might be some of the ramifications of such a departure on U.S. foreign policy and national security interests?
Well, I think every time that safe harbor is created, every time we give out what ounce for ounce is the most precious resource in the world, a United States green card, to sufferers of persecution, we send out messages of hope. We tell those regimes that you cannot lock up your own people, that there are outlets and escapes. We bring to the world voices that tell the rest of the world about what's happening, and we thereby strengthen American national security interests. That was exactly the notion behind Jackson-Vanik, which people said couldn't be done. You couldn't do anything to the Soviet Union. It placed, that refugee policy was the policy that placed the first big cracks in the walls of the Soviet Union. Refugee policy does it time after time after time. And I hope that we are more welcoming than, in my judgment, we have been to many religious refugees. And I hope we send out the signal that, yes, we will be a haven for victims of religious persecution from Iran.
Well, to both of you, I want to say thank you for, on behalf of the subcommittee, and to thank all of the witnesses for being here today and testifying at today's hearing. We're going to leave the record open until 5 p.m. on Wednesday, October the 4th, for members who perhaps were not able to be here today to submit additional documents into the record and perhaps even to ask questions in writing of any of the panelists. So with that and our thanks, this hearing is adjourned.
Thank you.